Welcome back. It's the second half of this here episode of Words and Movies, and I do hope you enjoyed whatever break you had.
I did. I just want to mention two things real quick before we move on. First of all, both things I forgot to mention about Persona. One is, along with Shame, this is one of the few movies that Bergman made to reference current events, as when Elizabeth is watching footage of coverage of the Vietnam War. And although Bergman was not a fan of the French New Wave, particularly not of Godard, Paul Schrader, the screenwriter, director, who has written a lot about Bergman, who used to be a film critic before he became a screenwriter and director, and has written about Bergman, among other filmmakers, argues that in Persona, Bergman is using the new wave techniques of having the camera or the director be a character in the story as much as the actors are. And that idea is taken up to the nth degree in Performance. And we're going to get to that. But first, Claude is going to now give us the plot description for Performance.
Yes, I am. So we open with alternating scenes of a car moving through the countryside and a man and a woman having some rather energetic, rough sex. The next morning, we learn that the couple is basically spending the night together for the first time, but they also appear to be making plans to meet again that night. The man is Chaz, played by James Fox, and if the only other thing you know him for is playing Veruca Salt's father in 2005 version of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, are you in for a surprise? Also, you haven't been paying attention because we just talked about him a few weeks ago in Absolute Beginners. Anyway, Chaz is basically an enforcer, for who works for a gangster named Harry Flowers. Flowers is played by Johnny Shannon. We see Chaz roughing up sordid businessmen, and alternating with this is a scene taking place in a courtroom where an attorney is presenting his defense of a client accused of financial chicanery. Between the sex scene and the bit with the businessman, it's clear that Chaz is a bit of a psychopath who maybe enjoys his work a little too much, to the point where it's bleeding into his personal life. The two scenes come together when Chaz meets up with the lawyer and his client and threatens the both of them into not implicating Flowers in the shady business deal for which he's being tried. The attorney doesn't take kindly to this, so Chaz and company get into his garage and pour acid all over his Rolls Royce and shave the chauffeur's hair off. Now, Chaz has a moment where he goes a little bit off book with his work, and he gets a talking to by Harry Flowers, who is starting to recognize that Chaz might be getting out of control. Flowers sends a crew to Chaz's place to beat him up and to whip him. And while he's being whipped, he keeps flashing back on the night of rough sex. When Chaz passes out, they go to get him some water so they can revive him, but he revives himself instead, and then he shoots one of the gangsters in the chest. And as the man squirms while he's dying, Chaz simply watches him enjoying it, and then he just throws the other one out of his apartment. But now, Chaz is in trouble with Harry Flowers, so he knows he's got to hide out somewhere. He packs some money that he stashed and a go bag, and he runs. Chaz calls Flowers and tries to tell him that the death was an accident and that he's loyal to Flowers, but it's during that phone call that Flowers makes the decision that Chaz has to go. Chaz figures this out right away, and he begins disguising himself and making plans to leave the country. But while he's waiting for a train, he overhears a conversation between two people and decides to hide out for the time being in an apartment in Notting Hill, owned by a man named Turner, who is played by Mick Jagger. Turner lives with two women named Ferber and Lucy. They're played respectively by Anita Pallenberg and Michel Breton. Chaz's first encounter is with Ferber, who's speaking largely in riddles as far as Chaz can tell. Turner, as it turns out, is a former rock star who has closed himself off from the world and shacked up with these two women, plus a young girl named Lorraine, while he tries to relocate his muse. The fact that Turner is locked away like this is what makes this apartment an ideal hideout for the time being. So he calls his friend Tony to let him know that he's leaving the country, but he's hiding out in the area for now, and he tells Tony where he's got the rest of his money stashed. After the phone calls, he goes upstairs to meet Turner himself. As he waits, he finds himself listening to recorded poetry about the decay of society. Turner enters and tells Chaz that the room isn't available. Somehow, Chaz manages to convince him to let him stay on a day-to-day basis. A few days later, Tony tells Chaz that he'll need a photo so that he can get a fake passport and encourages him to change his look. Chaz approaches Turner about borrowing a Polaroid camera, and Turner and Ferber spend some time trying to psych him out, asking confusing questions, but ultimately agreeing to dress him up and take the photos. However, they also slip him a psychedelic mushroom, which begins changing his perception of everything. While Chaz is changing his clothes, Turner notices the still healing marks on Chaz's back. Ferber treats the wounds, during which Chaz begins tripping hard. During the trip, Ferber lets on that she knows his real name. He accuses her of poisoning him, but Turner insists that the point of the mushrooms is so that they can better understand each other. Chaz starts to accept the trip he's on, and they begin to experiment with various outfits and identities, including cross-dressing. Turner begins to sing a song, but in Chaz's head, it's morphing back and forth so that he's having a memory of an earlier scene with flowers and his henchmen, with Turner in the flowers position. And at first, the dialogue is the same, even if it's being sung by flowers, but it morphs fully into the song Memo from Turner. And as the song ends, Turner tells Chaz to call his agent, which is who he thinks Tony is. Chaz calls Tony, and they arrange for him to pick up the photo. Turner tells Chaz that Tony can just come to the house and gives him the address. Chaz finally comes out of the psychedelic haze, waking up next to Lucy. The two of them start kissing, and we're led to assume that they have sex. Later, they're in the bathroom together, and she tries talking him out of leaving because Turner likes him. Lucy realizes that she's forgotten the shampoo, and Chaz goes upstairs to get it for her. Unfortunately, Harry Flowers has been using Tony to track down Chaz's whereabouts, and it's while Chaz is headed upstairs that he discovers Harry's crew waiting for him. Chaz is dressed in feminine clothing and wearing a wig. He convinces them to allow him to continue upstairs. Chaz goes into Turner's room to say goodbye, and Turner offers to come with him. Chaz turns him down, saying that Turner doesn't know where he's going. Turner insists, "Oh yes, I do. Indeed, no." Chaz looks out the window and sees that Flowers has men posted outside the building as well. Then he cocks the gun and he shoots Turner. The next thing we see is Chaz being escorted along the street toward Flowers' car. Lucy is still in the tub waiting for Chaz. Ferber, who was next to Turner when he was shot, is covered in blood, but she's hiding in a closet from Flowers' other men. One of them opens a different closet and sees Turner's lifeless body. He goes around the house and he surveys the general disarray. Chaz arrives at the car and gets in, but as it pulls away, we see that Chaz has Turner's face. Roll credits while we hear Randy Newman singing Gone Dead Train over a series of stills from throughout the film.
Now, this movie, although it was made in Britain with an all-British cast, was released by Warner Brothers. So we're tiny bit violating my rule here of trying to avoid Americans involved in any of these movies, but it was mostly a British crew and British cast. But the reason why I bring up Warner Brothers is, you know, in addition to the fact that they were the studio that released this movie both in the United Kingdom and the U.S. and other parts of Europe, is that when they heard that Mick Jagger was being attached to this, that they thought, oh, we're going to get another A Hard Day's Night. That fun, clean, enjoyable, peppy movie starring the Rolling Stones' rivals, the Beatles. Boy, was that not the case. Admittedly, when Donald Cammell, who, as I mentioned, was the writer of the movie, and some folks would say he's the main creative person involved in the movie, though I disagree, and we're going to get a little bit into that a little later, that he originally did mean this to be a lighthearted movie, He even originally wrote Shaz as an American, and Marlon Brando was first offered the part, but he turned it down. But then Kamel started getting into the works of Antonin Artaud, who's into memory, and Jorge Luis Borges. And I believe it's one of Borges' poems that Turner is reciting from in the movie, though I don't know which one it is. But because of those influences and because of the scene that was going on in London at the time, Kamel and director and his co-director, Rogue, made the movie darker. According to the IMDb trivia page, again, Kamel supposedly encouraged everyone working on the crew to get into drugs and to get into sex. And there have been all kinds of rumors going around about how the sex scenes between Anita Pallenberg, who was, by the way, Keith Richards' girlfriend at the time, and Mick Jagger were not simulated, nor were the scenes where Anita Pallenberg was shooting up drugs, that all of those were, you know, all of those were real rather than fake. And because of that, Warner Brothers and the audiences that they showed the movie to were so repulsed by the movie that they sat on it for 2 years.
Yeah, in fact, Pallenberg herself said that that one shot of her, like where she's injecting something into her backside, was indeed her shooting heroin.
Right. And so it got delayed when it came out in 1970. And the reaction of critics at the time was pretty divided. Persona had a lot of criticism of it at the time as well. You know, Andrew Saras said that this was the point where he gave up on Bergman, where Susan Sontag called it maybe the best movie ever made. But as far as performance goes, Gene Siskel liked the first 40 minutes of the movie, but then he thought it went off the rails. Roger Ebert said it was only worth watching for Jagger's performance, which we're going to get into in a little bit. And Richard Schickel called it the most disgusting movie he had ever seen. So it was not well received by audiences at the time either. But over the years, it's developed a cult following. It ranked pretty high on, as I recall, on the list of best British movies ever made. And while I don't rank it in the same class as Persona, of course, I do think it's quite a film. What do you think of it, Claude?
Yeah, again, this is one of those you kind of have to get through a little bit before you settle into the story itself, you know, just to kind of figure out what's going on and how these oddball things kind of tie together. And so I could understand, you know, the comment that you know, the first 40 minutes versus the rest of the film, because it does sort of have the feel of two different films going on. And but that's not necessarily a good or bad thing. It's just it's what it is. But because basically what you've got is a long prologue into the main heart of the story, and to a certain extent, you need a lot of this setup to understand like why these people are where they are. So, you know, that isn't necessarily a bad thing. But yeah, I, you know, watching this film for the first time, and I was like a little bit confused as what's going on here. Why are we seeing these particular images? Because you are getting, you know, a lot of graphic images, and it's not like, it's not porn specifically, but you do see, like, you know, naked breasts and naked butts and, you know, that kind of thing. But it's And then the fact that it's clearly, as I said, it's kind of angry and violent sex that is going on at the beginning of the film. And so you have to wonder why this is important. And then you kind of get it later on when Chaz is being beaten and it's not really bugging him that much. You know, I mean, he's not enjoying it, but at the same time, he's thinking about the date he had a night or two ago and how that went. And it's like kind of comparing the two and you say, oh, okay, that's what this guy's about. It's just one more notch up that this guy's crazy ladder. So it all does tie together in the long run. On a first watch, yeah, I could see people going, what in the hell? But you take the time to digest it a little bit, and then you start realizing, oh, this makes a lot more sense than you'd think.
Now, in addition to the literary influences that I mentioned, there were a couple real-life influences here as well. Harry Flowers and the rest of the gangsters were inspired by the craze being the most notorious British gangster, possibly who ever lived, certainly in the 60s. They've had a couple movies made about them. One, my favorite of them, was directed by Peter Medak in 1990, with two folks from Spandau Ballet playing the Krays, and that works a lot better than it sounds. And then there was a movie made about 10, 15 years ago called Legend with Tom Hardy playing both roles. That I wasn't as big a fan of. And the Krays, by the way, were really vicious. Oh, and they were parodied by Monty Python in their sketch, The Piranha Brothers. The Krays were really some of the most vicious gangsters around. They were violent. They didn't have a lot of the, I hesitate to say, redeeming qualities.
Okay.
But certainly not any of the public qualities that we associate with American gangsters who have been mythologized in movies and books and things like that. You know, there was no courtliness about them like you'd see in the Godfather movies, for example, or, you know, knowledge of culture, knowledge and love of culture, like you saw in real life with Al Capone and in movies made about him, or with Benny Siegel, better known as Bugsy, though you would never call him that to his face. None of those qualities. They were just straight out brutes. So that was one of the real world influences on this movie.
Not especially smart ones either. You know, there was one scene where Harry's trying to get some kind of point across about like a mad dog, and one guy's just kind of sitting on the side of the room like, yeah, I got bit by a dog once. Like, you are so missing the point.
Yeah, well, that's his associates more than the Krays, but yeah, that's true as well. And then there's also the character of Turner. While Mick Jagger is including some of himself in here, most of it is coming from his late bandmate, Brian Jones, who was also very much a recluse and didn't like talking to people and was also heavy into drugs. I mean, a lot of rock musicians, of course, in the 60s were into drugs, but Jones apparently more than a lot. And so that was definitely an influence. And the whole monologue scene that is delivered by the lawyer, who, by the way, is played by Alan Cuthbertson, who I first saw on an episode of The Avengers, the John Steed Emma Peel Avengers, not the Marvel comic book series. Mm-hmm. But he's a British character actor who's been in a lot of things, including one of the best, what I would argue is the best of the kitchen sink dramas that came out of Britain in the late 50s and early 60s, our Angry Young Man movies, Room at the Top. But I believe that whole monologue was inspired by a real case, though I don't know which one. And certainly, as with a lot of gangster movies that have come out before and since, it's explicitly tying gangsterism to capitalism. Mm-hmm. So, which is part of the real world that the movie is touching on before we, again, jump down the rabbit hole. Now, as far as that rabbit hole goes, as I said, Donald Cammell is given a lot of credit for this movie, that basically that this is his. And certainly he was responsible for the content of the movie. His career, he was a painter, and certainly that was an influence on this movie as well, visually. And up to this point, his only credit was co-writing the screenplay to a caper movie from 1968 called Duffy, which James Fox was also in, where he plays this foppish playboy who decides to pull off a robbery, robbing his father, played by James Mason, with the help of, among others, Susanna York and James Coburn. And it was pretty much a light, in the tone of the light caper movies that came out in the 1960s, and completely different from the tone of this movie. And after this movie, he went on, his most well-known movies were mostly horror movies, like Demon Seed with Julie Christie, and White of the Eye with Kathy Moriarty. But as much as Cammell may have been responsible for the content, the look of the movie, I would argue, is chiefly from Nicholas Rogue. Now, Rogue started out as a cinematographer. He was one of the cinematographers on Lawrence of Arabia, for example, and he was the second unit photographer, and he also shot some scenes of Lean's follow-up movie, Dr. Zhivago. But his main films as a cinematographer were Petulia, and he also served, and Far From the Madding Crowd, and he also served as cinematographer on this movie as well. Mm-hmm. And he, in his later movies, became known for that fragmented editing style where you'd get a scene juxtaposed with another scene that you didn't know how it would connect at first, but then it makes some sense when, as you're watching the film. And like this movie, he told many, though not all, of his movies in a non-linear fashion. And also, he went on to work with musicians playing actors in a couple of his movies as well. In The Man Who Fell to Earth with, mm-hmm, David Bowie in his first movie, and Bad Timing with Art Garfunkel. And speaking of Bad Timing, Rogue also pushed the envelope as far as content goes in his movies with regard to sex. Not so much with violence, but definitely with sex and nudity. Don't Look Now, for example, a movie that he did with Julie Christie, along with Donald Sutherland, has a sex scene in there that is so realistically done. Again, you'd swear it was not simulated. So there's a lot of elements in this movie, even in movies that are don't push the envelope as much as far as content as with a Rogue movie that we're going to talk about in a future episode, Insignificance. There's still a lot of stylistic elements in here that show up in most of his movies. So I think Rogue deserves as much credit for this movie as Camel does, or if you don't like the movie, as much blame.
Well, yeah, I think there's a little bit of that. You can see that, you know, his influencing, especially with the editing at the beginning of the film. But then also, you mentioned the look of the whole thing, and I think we also have to look at John Clark's art direction, you know, if only because of the way that the way that Turner's entire house looks, just the various items that are strewn about the place. There's mirrors on the ceiling in some rooms. There's funky artworks on the walls, that sort of thing. And then there's also there's one scene where it's early in the film, and Turner is in the bathtub, and I think he's with both women, or he's with one of them at one point, and then the other one gets in during the scene. And there's a shot from basically across the bathroom, and there's a table in the room, and on that table is a container of brown sugar. And I was like, well, that's interesting. I mean, the song Brown Sugar hadn't been written yet, but, you know, Mick Jagger did have a habit of, you know, dating women not of his race. So there could have been a little bit of a visual gag going on there as well. But the fact that you've got this particular place, which is in great disarray, but also not necessarily dirty, is just an interesting kind of look going on, and maybe gives us a pretty good peek into Turner's headspace.
Right. And one of the other peaks into his headspace, or maybe into Chaz's, of course, is in the whole memo from Turner sequence. Now, although Jack Nietzsche, who was best known for being a composer and arranger on a lot of Phil Spector's produced hits, he's the one credited with the score for this movie. The most memorable song from the movie is Memo from Turner. Martin Scorsese, for one, used it in that whole sequence where Henry Hill is drugged out of his mind and hyper up on cocaine on the day he eventually gets arrested, among other songs, in Goodfellas. And originally, the Rolling Stones were going to record that song as well as songs for the rest of the soundtrack, but that plan got scuttered. Whether you believe it was because Keith Richards refused to play on the song because he was jealous of Jagger's relationship with Anita Pallenberg, although Richards did co-write the song, although Claude is going to have more to talk about that. But Ry Cooder ended up playing the guitar on the song. And there are a couple songs that we do hear from Mary Clayton, the title track to the movie, and a song called Poor White Hound Dog. And Clayton, of course, does that memorable vocal on the Stones' Gimme Shelter. But Memo from Turner, for me, and I'm sure for a lot of people, is easily the most memorable sequence in the performance. And it's the first time that you see Jagger really act like Jagger rather than like Turner. And the combination of Jagger and Brian Jones, as I mentioned, that he was doing there. Now, Claude, you mentioned you wanted to bring up some stuff about the song as well.
Well, specifically, I was thinking about not so much Memo from Turner, which, does, as you say, it does have an interesting, you know, look and feel to it, and is probably the best, one of the best known songs that comes from here. And it's kind of interesting because when Jagger is singing that song, you know, as you say, he's like more like himself than any other time. And at the same time, he doesn't look the way he typically does. In fact, when he is Turner, he looks a little bit more like you would remember Jagger from the mid-60s through about the mid-80s. He had that same general haircut going on and overall feel to the way he looked, with the exception of like the eye makeup. But anyway, no, what I was thinking about was there was another track that got played a few times by Ry Cooder in the film, and it was the title is Poets Hill, which is the neighborhood that the house is located in, and it's this real bluesy kind of thing. And it was one of those things that when I was watching the film, I was like, this sounds really, really familiar, and I got to go look it up, because to me it sounded a little bit like Blind Willie Johnson's Dark Was the Night, Cold Was the Ground. All right. It's got that same feel to it with just like some bottleneck slide guitar going on with a little bit of picking in between and that kind of thing. And you hear it, of course, when he first gets there, but it also comes up a couple of times in between in other scenes in the film. And it was just kind of interesting because, you know, Poets Hill is no lyrics whatsoever. It's just Cooter, you know, playing on this guitar. Dark Was the Night, Cold Was the Ground was, now, if you listen to Blind Willie Johnson, his lyrics are, as he sings, are almost unintelligible. But the song itself is basically about Jesus accepting the crucifixion. And so you get the same kind of feel where, you know, there are people in this film who are one way or another taking on a certain fate, accepting that fate, and doing whatever they have to do to get to the next place. It was just one of those things that had me wondering, you know, well, if I got to ask Ry Cooder what was his inspiration for this, I'd be willing to bet Dark Was the Night, Cold Was the Ground, specifically Blind Willie Johnson's recording, was a direct influence on this track.
Well, given how much Cooter is a fan of blues, that wouldn't be surprising. Now, we should also talk about James Fox's performance. Yes. Although I know you never hesitate to bring up Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Just to irritate you.
Fox is better known for playing these upper-class characters, whether they're villain characters like the one he played in Absolute Beginners, or good guy characters like the ones he played in A Passage to India, The Russia House, and Patriot Games.
Oh, okay.
Or characters where you're kind of questioning their motives all the way through, such as the made-for-HBO movie Doomsday Gun. But he's normally playing these upper-class characters. Even before this movie came out, Duffy, of course, even though he's this foppish type character, he's playing an upper-class character, or someone who's coming from money, even though he needs money. He gives the air of being someone to the manner born. And then also in a Joseph Losey movie he did before this called The Servant, he is playing these to the manner born characters. But even though apparently the experience of making this movie so freaked him out that he joined a religious cult and stopped acting for a decade after making this movie, he is surprisingly convincing as this brutish gangster. The same as someone who knows how to handle himself, someone who, like his bosses, has no real manners, no real line that he won't cross, and yet at the same time has this code that he wants to stick to, or he thinks that he's sticking to, until he meets Turner.
Yeah, and at the same time, you know, I don't think we would say that he has the same attitude going on as his boss. Like I said, he is a brutish guy, but he's one of these guys who he would do it even if he weren't getting paid for it. Like, he just likes it that much. And at the same time, he's just got such this cold exterior going on that you really have to keep wondering, like, where he's coming. Like, is he crazy, or is he just especially good at what he does, or what is his story here? And that's, I think, one of the appeals of his characters in general, as you said, like so many of them, where, you know, they've got this kind of exterior going on and you really don't know whether he's a good guy or bad guy, what are his motives, what's going on behind his eyes. You know, this is one of the things that makes it work especially well for him.
Okay, so do you have anything you want to add here before we wrap this up?
Just, I think this is something that we need to address, is like, as we get toward the end of the film and they start doing these experiments with the dress and the personas and the individual identities and that kind of thing, and we see where Chaz is starting to wear the wig and he starts to put on makeup and that kind of thing, and once again, we actually see the personality starting to merge to the point where everybody is actually starting to look like everybody else, with, I think, the exception of Pallenberg. It's really Lucy and Turner and Chaz who kind of start morphing into different versions of each other, such that there's one point when Chaz wakes up and he's next to Lucy. I actually had a moment where I thought he had woken up next to Turner. It was like that crazy at that point. And then when you had the scene with where Pallenberg comes in and is holding the mirror up to his face, and at one point she's holding it so that it's up against her face, so he is seeing his face framed by her hair, and another shot where she's holding the mirror and it's half her face and half his face, which was a direct like shot to persona, I think. And then there was a similar scene, a similar thing that she did with the mirror, would just to change the way that he perceives himself or they perceive each other. You know, I think that that's one of the things that also, that also made Fox a good casting choice, because all it did was take a little bit of makeup on him and a little bit more makeup on Jagger to get these two guys to look more like one another, so that by the time you get to that reveal at the end, because remember, when they're leading him out of the building and down toward Flower's car, you see him from the back, okay? Every time they cut back to him, all you see is from the back, until finally he gets in the car, and then the car starts to move, and as the car passes the camera, that's where you see Jagger's face. And so I think that's just kind of interesting that they have given us all these clues in these last 15, 20 minutes of the film that there is some sort of transformation going on with these characters. And it's just as much physical as anything else.
which is why, you know, I've sometimes joked that this is the distaff version of Persona.
Yeah.
Even though in many ways they're two totally completely different movies, both of these movies have the psychological transference going on.
Mm-hmm.
While Camel, as I said, was influenced by Artaud and Borges, Bergman was influenced by Jung, who's written a lot about psychological transference. Mm-hmm. And so I think that ties these two together. Anything else?
Except that I think the only major difference between these two is at the very end of Persona, basically Alma has rejected the transference, whereas Chaz appears to have accepted it.
Okay, maybe so. Maybe
and
so.
Because of the death of Turner. He had to kill Turner to become Turner.
Maybe so. But now is the time when we tell you that both of these movies are available on DVD.
Mm-hmm.
Persona is on Criterion DVD and then also on another edition DVD that I used to have until I picked up the Criterion one. Performance is available on DVD through Warner Brothers home video, but if you prefer to watch them online, Persona, you can stream if you subscribe to either the Criterion channel or HBO Max, or if you happen to subscribe to HBO Max through Amazon. Or you can rent or buy it through Amazon or Apple TV only. As for Performance, you could rent or buy it through Amazon, Apple TV, Google Play, Microsoft TV, Vudu, or YouTube. And coming up in our next episode, we're going to France.
Oui.
And we're going to be taught specifically French movies, specifically French crime movies. And so we're going to be talking about Breathless, or A Bout de Souffle, directed and co-written by Jean-Luc Godard, and Le Cercle Rouge, or The Red Circle, written and directed by Jean-Pierre Melville. And both of them are available on DVD, Criterion DVD. But again, if you prefer to stream them, Breathless, you can stream through the Criterion channel or HBO Max, or HBO Max if you subscribe to it through Amazon. Or if you're lucky enough to have a library that subscribes to Canopy, mm-hmm. you can watch it for free through that, or you can rent or buy it through Amazon, Apple TV, Google Play, Vudu, or YouTube only. Whereas Le Cercle Rouge, you can currently only rent through Amazon, Apple TV, Google Play, or YouTube. And if you have a question or a comment on any of our episodes, you can comment on our page, you can comment on our Facebook page, or you can email us. Our email address is wordsandmoviespod@gmail.com. And myself, Sean Gallagher, I am on Facebook. And I'm still lurking on Instagram. And how about you, Claude?
Well, yeah, you can find me on the Book of Face under my own name. You can also check out my other podcast, How Good It Is, at howgooditis.com. And as far as the shows of socials, Facebook seems to be where the action is. That's where I see the most of anything going on. And that would be facebook.com/wordsandmovies.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time.
In France, with Rebecca. Speaking of whom, please take us out.
This is your announcer, Rebecca Blackman, with the closing credits. This show was produced by Sean Gallagher and Claude Call, with editing and post-production by Claude, with some help from Mophonic. Audio clips are used under fair use rules for commentary and educational framing. Everything else is copyrighted by Claude Call and Sean Gallagher. The theme music you're bopping along to right now is by Solar Flare and is used under a Creative Commons license. Podcast hosting is provided by Anchor.fm. If you want to support the show, go to anchor.fm/wordsandmovies and click on the support link. Who knows? Maybe they'll even kick a few bucks my way. Thanks for listening.